Welcome back to Exploring the Arts. My name is Joel Thiel.
And my name is Ian McMillan.
And today we are here with the great Dr. Jordan Dorney. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Awesome. We have a lot of really interesting stuff to get into. So, Ian, you want to kick us off?
Yeah. I mean, you know, without further ado, just the first question we ask all these people we have on here, just who are you?
Well, I, at NSA, I am a fellow of history. This is my first year here. And so I teach the history colloquium for sophomores with Dr. Schlecht. We split the sophomores and do some other electives in history.
Awesome. Great.
What other electives do you teach in specific?
This year, I did one on Xenophon's Cyropaideia. So Xenophon's a Greek historian, student of Socrates. I am teaching right now a class on the Federalist and the Anti-Federalist too. But, you know, got to get them in. And then I did also a class on Machiavelli. So very exciting courses, I think, this year.
Nice. Great. So doing history, what, you know, very broad question, why are you interested in history? Very broadly, and then we can narrow down more specifics as we
Well,
go.
You've been in my class, so you know, Ian, that I am interested in a certain set of big questions and then all sorts of things that flow from there. Mm-hmm. I think the kind of the core of everything for me is the text. Okay. So whatever questions are prompted by whatever it is that we're reading, those are the ones I'm interested in. Hmm. But as far as history in particular goes, you know, what is history? That seems like a basic question. But
yeah, what is history?
Yeah.
We still don't know.
And what isn't it? So is history the same, for instance, as poetry or literature? How does it relate to that? Mm-hmm. How does it relate to philosophy or theology, some of these other things? So those kinds of questions that situate it within the liberal arts and humanities, that's pretty much where I start. You know that I like to spend a lot of time at the beginning of things. So that's where I spend most of my time, I think.
And what's been the biggest influences on you to shape your idea of what history is and how we should study it?
I think books and teachers are the two biggest things. So I think at the core of it all, it's a distinctively Christian approach to history informs everything that I'm working from. So even if we're reading Thucydides, Herodotus, whatever it might be, I think that's such an essential part of a Reformed perspective on the world and a Christian idea of liberal arts. History is maybe even history as a Christian concept. When we're doing the ancient pagans, just seeing how different of a worldview it is that you get from them when it comes to defining those basic questions about what history is, where things are going. That's one of those things that is really interesting to me. And so that, I think, is a big influence on how I approach whatever it is that I'm taking up in class.
Yeah. So to you, it's really important to get into the mindset of whoever it is you're studying and really evaluate their time, their circumstances from their perspective.
Yeah, and especially to do that from the text itself. So there are ways that it's useful to contextualize things from the outside. You know, this is the century that Herodotus is living in or that Bede is living in, whatever it might be. But for me, the biggest thing is how does this book present itself? What are the parameters that it has for what we're doing when we pick it up and try to understand it? That for me is the one of the central questions.
Yeah. So, and what are some of the particular problems that arise kind of when you don't have kind of a nuanced approach to history? Like if you kind of just take history as just, a collection of facts about some old people, right? Like what, either that or some other problems we've talked about in class, what are some of the problems there?
Yeah. So I think one problem of only going to the outside is that, you know, you're trying to solve a problem, whatever it is, it's hard to interpret this part of the text or you're not sure what exactly is going on here. If you're always just appealing only to the outside, you're kind of getting around the problem and not really trying to solve it.
Yeah.
So for me, I think that's one of the reasons why I make you all stick with the text, at least as long as we can. Again, there's lots of good reasons to go outside and, you know, doing all of this with no context, I think causes all sorts of other problems on the other side of the road. But that would be the main thing that I'm trying to do to keep us confronting the problem rather than just avoiding it.
And what do you, when you're teaching history, what is your relationship with your students? Like, are you learning through them as well while you're teaching?
Definitely. I think I learn much more from teaching a particular text than even just reading it on my own. Mm-hmm. There's lots of insights that you get when you have to present something in an organized way to other people. So maybe that's how I learn from myself when I teach. But certainly the students always have really interesting insights. I always want to spend more time on those things. I think if they gave me twice as much time to go through all this stuff, I'd be twice as happy. I don't know what the limit is of that. Maybe 10 times. I don't know. I guess it would depend on how willing they are to participate in that. But yeah, no, I'm definitely learning all the time from the process of teaching and what it is that students have to say about these things.
Awesome. Yeah. And so moving on from that, talk to us about your Christian journey, your testimony going through, you know, your younger life in college.
Sure. So, grew up, Presbyterian. Mm-hmm. My parents had been, Roman Catholic, but, over time became Reformed. So grew up in the OPC, you know, really solid preaching, good church, great pastor. When I went to college, you know, I, from the beginning, was doing great books and all that stuff, being very serious, being very self-important, and I think self-righteous often about a lot of this stuff. Didn't make a good connection to a local church, and it kind of all my problems flowed from those kinds of things and from that approach. And thankfully, in going to grad school, normally people's grad school story is sort of the opposite of this. They get, I think they get worse by going to grad school. From the first week that I was there, got connected with a really good PCA church with a great pastor, and just got taught out of all my bad habits and problems that I had fallen into in the course of all of this. Mm-hmm. And, really totally changed, I think, how I interacted even with, you know, my studies and all that.
Yeah. And so kind of building on that idea, it seems, you know, your Christianity definitely influenced your passion for, you know, your studies and all these, the great books and the classics and all these things. And so kind of what, was there anything in particular about kind of the period in your life that got you interested in history or political stuff?
Yeah. So when I was a freshman, as an undergrad, I knew I wanted to study political science. Mm. I don't really think I knew what that was.
Okay.
I'm not sure most people that sign up for political maybe any science, major, but especially something like political science, I'm not sure they know what it is. You know, it's things happening in the news, something like that. But from that first class, it just was a total shift, in perspective. Okay. And so, there was just a, I was sort of forced to confront a lot of different issues.
Sure.
And having great books, great teachers was an important part of that.
And so would you say that's true of most majors, that most people don't really know what they're getting into in studying these sorts of things? Like,
yeah, I think there's a lot of accidental learning that happens from all sorts of misconceptions about what things are. Now, that could be true of the liberal arts themselves.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But I think everyone has an idea of what they want to become and what major supposedly will lead to that. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times those are not based in reality.
Yeah, fair.
Yeah. And so your studies of political science, how does that interact with your teaching history?
First, what is political science?
That's a good question.
The questions are only getting harder here.
Well, I guess we don't know what history is.
So if I don't know, yeah, exactly. If I don't know what history is, why should I know what political science is? No, well, I think the great thing about political science is that you can define it really broadly. And for me, it ends up looking something more like just a broad approach to the humanities in general. So drawing on literature, drawing on philosophical treatises, on philosophy, drawing on all sorts of texts and different kinds of materials to try to get at questions about how we organize our lives together.
Sure.
You know, is the good man the same as the good citizen? The standard questions that people ask. That was really what drove my initial study of political science. Mm-hmm. And I think as I did that, starting to work on the history of political thought, that was kind of the inroad into history. Besides all the particular things, you know, all this is old stuff, so it sort of has a historical element, but I think the particularly historical focus comes once you try to give an account of how all these pieces fit together, why these ideas are presented in the way that they are over time, how context matters for the articulation of these different ideas about how, again, we organize our lives together. That is sort of my inroad into history. So I know, you know, lots of people, it's some particular cultural thing or another artifact of society. You know, I think it's a little bit, maybe it's less popular or less fancy to say, well, it's politics that drove me into history.
Yeah.
But for me, it's politics that got me into history.
Awesome. And would there be an element of anthropology in that study of like how humans interact with each other?
Yeah. So as long as you define anthropology in a good classical way and not in terms of modern social science, then yeah. I think anthropology, if by anthropology, I give the stipulated definition of the study of human beings, then I think that's what really connects it to the humanities, to the liberal arts. As far as, again, this peculiarly modern approach to anthropology that tries to understand man through large end statistical studies, I don't really want anything to do with that. So I tried to avoid taking those kinds of classes as much as I could, you know, getting a degree in social science. I had to at least do a couple, but you know, that's the cost of it all.
Yeah. And people often say that history is circular. Right. So when you're studying the people of in past generations, do you see parallels between our time and theirs?
So I will preface my answer by saying this is one of those questions that we come back to again and again in class, because there's all sorts of bad ways that you can try to make those kinds of connections. Mm-hmm. Right. It's really easy to say this is like this, therefore it's kind of the same.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And there you go. Now I have my insight. I can apply this in a wooden way, in a kind of slavish way to whatever my own thing is. And it's all about helping me. Mm-hmm. There's a sort of presentist bias in it all. Or you could be talking about two historical things and sort of trying to be smashing them together. And there's a problem there too, because you're not really understanding either one of those things. Mm-hmm. So before I get to those historical analogies, I think I always try to get the students to sort of reset, figure out what's going on, try to understand these things in their own terms, and then think about, okay, now what can we make of these kinds of connections? Because of course, you know, you want to do the study of history, you want to do the study of all these subjects in a way that corresponds to a human life and not just in this abstract acquisition of knowledge sort of way that you get sucked into, right? You don't want to become an antiquarian.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think this is true of kind of NSA classes generally, in that there's a big focus on kind of smashing your, you know, in my case anyway, just like kind of modern American assumptions about things and then rebuilding an explicitly Christian thing in its place. And so, you know, particularly in this case, you mentioned kind of modern scientific approaches to these things. So can you kind of give a few more examples of like specifically what that looks like? What kind of things are going through your head and what you're fighting against in your students' kind of presuppositions about history and all these things?
So hopefully this one doesn't apply to students here at NSA, but you might, for instance, come to everything with a kind of Marxian perspective, right? Everything is about social class. And so when I study Herodotus, when I study the Middle Ages, when I study the 19th century in America, it's always about the class struggle. And this is the pattern that I'm forcing onto the world when I do those things. That would be a kind of perspective that would be important to confront, because it's not growing out of a genuine observation of of what we're looking at. You know, you want to describe what you're actually seeing. So it's important not to have all these blinders on. And again, this is not the common one, I think, for NSA students, but it's a good thing to beat up on. So it's a low hanging fruit, maybe. But there's all sorts of consequences for our particular observations or ideas about things that come from our unexamined perspectives, our unexamined theories that we bring to bear on whatever it is. And so sometimes that's just about spelling out the Christian consequences of things. Sometimes it's about realizing that we've taken on a kind of alien worldview in some area of life and then sort of confronting it with some real facts. So it can vary in how it manifests itself. And there's sort of a difference between what students are facing when they do this and then, you know, the way the world operates and the kinds of errors that people fall into in this way. But I think both of those are important to confront when we're studying history.
And was that like kind of Marxist ideology. Was that something that you dealt with more during college and yeah. probably
now
maybe
let's get into the discussion.
Am I now or have I ever been a Marxist?
Is that no, no, that you've had to yeah. potentially, like you've been around, you've been surrounded
yeah.
by.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah. So certainly there's ideas that are drawn from all different kinds of sources, the premises of which, the principles of which I wouldn't agree with or accept, that are important to recognize when you're in dialogue with other people. And so, you know, I was in, for graduate school, I was in a Roman Catholic university. So, okay, there's some Romish things, right, that come out maybe from students with those kinds of commitments, but you know, the graduate students are not all Catholic, and so they often have other kinds of views that are there. And I think at the graduate level, at least, when you've been enabled in some way to confront those things carefully, it can be a good environment. Yeah. But the flip side of that is it's very easy to get carried away with all sorts of things that are in vogue, you know, whether it's critical theory or anything else, yeah. And then just kind of have this nice novelty that you can use and sure. feel like you're understanding something that no one else can understand, and really you're just replicating, you know, things that go back
yeah.
200 years that people just act like is not directly coming to bear on those things.
Yeah, what would be your strategy for, you know, studying history with, like, if you're surrounded by a lot of people with all sorts of different worldviews, and they're like, you know, looking at it through a lot of different lenses, how would you study the history? How would you walk through the text with them when they're not all sharing the same worldview?
You come from not a Christian university. You used to teach right. there. So yeah. I kind of want to jump into that.
Yeah,
sure. Kind of building off of that question. Yeah, yeah. So like, how did you approach it with people who weren't explicitly Christian?
So I was at a very, very, very large public university in the Southwest, which you could maybe guess which one it is from that description, in which I'm not sure that more than one or two of my students may have ever read the Bible, you know, in most of my classes. The way I did it was just make them read some of that stuff. So so some of it was, okay, I'm having them read the classics, right? We read some Aristotle, we read some Plato, we read some Locke and some Rousseau and some Hobbes and, you know, the other, yeah. the sort of standard texts and those kinds of things. But I also, for instance, made a bunch of those kids read 1st and 2nd Samuel and take Hannah's political theology seriously and take the story of David seriously, or read the book of Proverbs and the book of Ecclesiastes in the context of other ancient wisdom. And I think in that kind of context, there's lots of things that you can do. Now, I'm very happy here to just do things openly and completely that I could sort of only do in part or through different kind of devices there. And that makes me sound nefarious, right? Conspiratorial.
Scheming.
Yeah. I promise I wasn't scheming, although hopefully as many of those students as possible, you know, were struck by gospel truths insofar as I could, by a certain extended principle, give it to them. Yeah. There are a lot of things I think that you can do that don't require in a way a direct confrontation all the time, but can depend on just being forthright and confident. Mm-hmm. And this would be sort of the anti-conspiratorial perspective. Just be confident and say, okay, we've got to grapple with the Old Testament. What's going on? Mm-hmm. You don't seem as smart as the Old Testament is. So what are you going to do about it? I think just kind of going at it head on can be really useful. And using those things rather than just, you know, no one wants to hear Dr. Dorney's theory about life, right? So I try to never give that.
Yeah.
What I can do is present them with the text. And that goes back to what I said before, which is that the text for me is so central, so important to my teaching. Partly for this reason. Now, it plays itself out differently in those different contexts, but there's so much benefit that can come from displacing myself and my own ideas, you know, and replacing that with these books that we're still going to confront critically. You know, it's not just accept whatever Plato says, just believe, right? That that I think has all sorts of problems that flow from it too.
Yeah.
But you can make use of these things to drive the conversation, to break down people's, you know, their mental wall that they've built up against whatever they perceive this thing as being.
Yeah. And so how did that kind of go down in the case of like presenting biblical texts to people who never read the Bible? Like, was it generally fine?
I had a lot of fun.
Or?
I think it was great fun. I enjoyed it immensely. I probably in some sense could have kept doing it, although I'm much happier here. You know, it's not like you reach everyone every time says, oh, you know what, this really does make a lot of sense. But you do get some that say that, right? And you do get some softening of hearts or of minds there. And it's not because I'm so great at persuading them. But there, I think there's a lot of ways that, again, with just some, with confidence and a clarity, you make people deal with this stuff, and you would be surprised with the kind of reaction that you can get.
And so, like, as a, I guess, a follow-up question perhaps to that would be, I don't know, did you ever see that as a kind of method of evangelism to, like you said, softening hearts, or was it kind of more an attempt at breaking down presuppositions that people, like kind of modern biases against religious things or... I'll throw that out there.
Yeah, I think, you know, again, you don't want to overstep your role in these things for all sorts of reasons. I don't want to be an agent of the state imposing these things in a kind of arbitrary fashion on them, or they've signed up for this class and now suddenly they're having to deal with this stuff. I do want them to have to deal with it to some extent, but I think there's a right way of going about that. And that goes to what I said too, about just being open about it. What are we doing in this class? Well, one of the first things we're going to do is read 1 and 2 Samuel.
Yeah.
And whatever it
says, like the whole book,
that's what we're going to deal with. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I would use Hannah's prayer as my Westminster confession, right? So every time there was some question about the nature of God or how all these things fit together, what is the biblical perspective on political life or whatever it is, I would say, but remember what Hannah said,
right?
And that's one of those ways, I think, of displacing it from me. So I'm not trying to just say, well, here's what you need to know and believe about these things.
The text
now, it is what
the...
they need to know and believe about these things. That's perfectly true, but that is not always the best opener, at least in that kind of context. And so Hannah is there to preach the gospel to them, and I'm in the room too. You know, so there's things like that, I think, that were especially effective.
Were there any opportunities you had, like, to open any avenues towards
Like, how much fruit did that?
Right.
Like, were there kids who were kind of softened and opened to the gospel and, you know, were saved? Were there, do you have any fun stories?
I think, as is usual with this kind of thing, you know, you never know where people go with it. And so I don't know.
That's fair.
What any of the fruit of that might have been.
But you yourself never, you didn't have like a more drawn out conversation with an individual student or anything?
Not exactly in that way.
Yeah. Okay. Awesome. And what other texts did you talk about with them in that class?
Oh, let's see. We read a lot of interesting things. I had them do, so this would be another kind of example here. We read Aristotle's Ethics.
Okay.
And there is a section there where Aristotle is talking about, you know, what's worthy of a human being and what's beastly behavior.
Sure.
And it turns out a lot of the stuff that Aristotle, who isn't a Christian, in case you didn't know, thinks, there's a lot of things that Aristotle thinks are beastly and unworthy of a human being that perhaps some moderns do not find very beastly. And we had an interesting conversation that day about abortion and other things where it was a total reorientation of the normal.
Sure.
Yeah,
I think very anxious conversation that sometimes happens in classroom settings like that, where no one is quite sure what you're allowed to say. No one's quite sure what the script is for this thing, other than that we know that there's probably some very activist students. They're going to shout some things. And if anyone says anything contrary to that, there's going to be big problems, you know, socially or otherwise.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want to overblow it, but there's something like that. Well, when you say, well, Aristotle says, you're acting worse than an animal if you're in favor of these kinds of things. What do you think about that? Now it's
a little bit different. They can't pull the Christian card. Yeah. They can't just pull the fundamentalists.
Yeah. Like, you can't, there's no way of weaseling out of that.
Yeah.
You've got to say, you've got to say something real. Mm-hmm. Now maybe you still say some horrible thing, some beastly thing, but now there's a, now another student can have a genuine response to that, that isn't just driven by fear of, what can we say here in this classroom?
Yeah. It really seems like from what you're saying that these conversations come about more productively from a more subtle approach when you're not directly attacking the point. Mm-hmm. Like you don't invite them to class. Today we're having a conversation about abortion and bring your opinion.
I mean, so sometimes it's very subtle and sometimes it's confrontational. I think there's a good, you want to use a mixture of those things.
Right.
And honestly, that's true of teaching here too. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I'm working on a very subtle point. You know, we're deep in the weeds in Bede or in Herodotus and I'm just trying to extract some careful little tweak to how we're perceiving this idea or that idea. Mm. And then sometimes I'm rolling in like the bull in the china shop and presenting them with some crazy thing that now they've got to deal with.
Yeah.
So that itself doesn't necessarily vary in those two contexts, though the way you use it obviously varies and the fundamental assumptions that you have vary. So I never present myself as a pagan, right, in the classroom here. So when I take the part of Herodotus or Thucydides, it's always with, I think, a certain additional element there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And what do you mean by when you say take the part of Herodotus or Thucydides? What is that? What exactly does that mean?
So this is what I was meaning before, that I'm not there to give Dr. Jorney's ideas about history. Right. I don't care about that. And I hope none of the students really care about that because that's not the point, right? Yeah. You're not sitting there dutifully writing down lecture notes so that you can get a good grade on the exam so that when you graduate, you can say, aha, I know all of Dr. Dorney's doctrines.
Yeah.
that doesn't help anyone. So instead, what I try to do is present a good case for the text, defend against various objections, make some objections of my own if the students aren't being mean enough to Herodotus or aren't ascribing wicked enough motives to him, whatever it might be, and just try to maneuver around these things in such a way that the most independent understanding is coming from the students so that they're the ones doing the work.
Yeah.
Obviously I'm there as a guide, but I try not to be much more than a guide. Mm-hmm. I had a professor once, this is one of those, stories, right, that you remember from school. He was critiquing my writing and it was a good critique and it was a bad paper. But he would say, well, you're like one of those tour guides who says, there's the pyramids, there's the Sphinx. just sort of pointing things out. And I said, well, I don't know, the pyramids, look at the pyramids. That's the point, not me. And I've doubled down. Maybe I've rejected my great professor's advice there. But I think there's a real thing to that. If I'm going to point at Bede, it's because he is more important than me in that context.
Totally. That's great. And so, kind of building off of that, what would you say is the, one, why is it important for Christians to kind of have a in-depth understanding of not only history itself, but, the methods of actually doing history, and what kind of implications does that have on the Christian life broadly?
Well, I think you have to recognize just how historical Christianity is. Mm-hmm. We're not professing an abstract esoteric faith. We're saying something about what happened when we say the creed, right? There's characters in the creed, not just sort of statements and definitions of things. So I think the importance of it should be obvious to every Christian. But beyond that, or outflowing out from that, I think there's a way in which it's important to confront these fundamentally different perspectives on history. So it's really easy to just assume that a basically Christian idea of history has always prevailed, mostly because we don't identify it as a Christian idea of history. And so when we go to Herodotus or Thucydides and we find out that they kind of don't think the world is going anywhere, and maybe even as one of my old professors said, she said, I don't believe in history, sort of like the Greeks.
Yeah.
And then asked whatever question it was. And just again, one of these striking statements that you remember, there's people that don't believe in history. That's an important thing to think about. So what does it mean not to believe in history the way that we do as Christians? Mm. You recognize more, I think, about what it is that we're saying when we have these commitments by having an idea of how things could be different. And I think broadly, this is one of the lessons that people will often bring up about the study of history. You see how things could be in some other way. Hmm. So whether that's the metaphor of travel or some other metaphor, you're seeing other ways that people do things, and the point isn't just to learn more information about that, but but to get at what you are doing.
Yeah, totally. Right? And those differences they're not incidental differences. Those are a lot of that informs things you vote on or how you raise your family and all of these things. I think that's one of the big things that I've in taking your class kind of been. Enlightened too is just the immense practicality of a lot of this in kind of understanding how to approach history that really does affect your everyday life in very real ways and how you deal with world events and all these other things. It's not as simple as just the journalists, just put forth a picture of what happened and that's good enough for me. There really is something going on and then a connection kind of to in God's sovereign plan to the rest of the world.
Well, and so. I would say that's despite my best efforts to be constantly resisting a so-called practical application of what we're talking about, because I think it would be easy to have a very flat application. I mean, this is true when you're talking about scripture. It's true when you're talking about other things. They're sort of the lazy version of making a practical application. How should I do this thing or that thing on the basis of this text? And you want sort of the direct, the text says do this. Okay, that's what I'll do.
Yeah.
But what you actually have to learn is how do I live my life because this is true?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that's going to be more of a fundamental thing than just, what should I get for breakfast tomorrow or something like that, which is almost like what people are looking for when they want that practical element in the liberal arts. But I think this goes to what is fundamentally practical about it. Mm-hmm. You're going to live your life in a certain way.
Yeah, definitely. Well, that's wonderful. Yeah.
And that seems to be how you fit history into the liberal arts, because, the liberal arts, they're all concerned with helping you understand your surroundings and have an understanding of the past and understanding of God and everything around you. So with history, how does history help us to understand the future, where we're going?
That's a thing we've talked about in class before, in that I don't know, back in the Thucydides discussions, for example, is one of the primary motives of history, kind of just adding on to what Joel said, is one of the primary motives to understand the future, or is it, are we fortune telling and all these sorts of things, or is it more nuanced than that?
Yeah, what does it mean, for instance, that Thucydides says his book is going to be a possession for all time? Yeah.
Right.
Is it just because it's interesting to know stuff that happened a long time ago? Is it because fortune teller's perspective, I can predict what's going to happen. And so I can sort of gamble on the future by being a really good historian. I think neither of those views is especially useful.
Sure.
The reason why it is potentially an eternal possession is because it's something that you need to constantly be confronting. Mm-hmm. The lessons that you're learning from the text are permanent things.
Sure.
They're not just about these temporary events. Mm.
That's great. Awesome. Well, in closing, we always ask our the people we interview some fun facts. So I guess just starting off this section, just what do you do for fun outside of school?
Mostly it's connected to school. So a lot of reading.
It seems to be a theme.
I think this is what happens when you base your whole life around this kind of thing, is that you base your whole life around this kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Lots of reading. My wife is also an academic, and so reading things together has been a very wonderful thing in our lives. maybe I've once or twice convinced her of something, you know, an interpretation of a text.
Sure.
And maybe once or twice she's convinced me. But we have very lively and fun conversations about those things.
Yeah.
Having the kids around is great, playing with them. I think the other day we were talking about how the students have the commonplace books where they put sayings from their professors or from other students or, you know, things that they hear. I think my older daughter now is sort of a walking, talking, commonplace book. And I have learned that I say things in a weird way. And that maybe Mrs. Dorney might also say things in a weird way because I have heard many of this put back to me. And I wonder, how could anyone say something like that? What does that mean? And then I remember that I probably said that.
Wonderful. One of the things you put on here under fun facts is you indulge your Irish heritage. What does that mean?
So I went to school in Boston and then I went to Notre Dame, the Fighting Irish and all of that. And you would think that I chose those things because I'm very invested in my Irish heritage. And you're not totally wrong, but mostly wrong. But I do, besides reading about the Greeks, which is probably my primary interest, I also like reading and studying things about Ireland. I have some very, very rusty Irish language skills. I took some Irish classes as an undergrad. And surprisingly, that doesn't get a lot of use in my work or in my social life, but it was very fun. And one of the things I do like to do, although it's not the main component of my teaching, is language study.
Okay.
And so this is a great place to be for that, but I've got to actually, I can't just phone it in. Sure. My Greek has to actually be good if I'm here on campus. And so I have to actually practice and get better. So that is also one of the things that I do.
Mm. All right.
Wonderful.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.